Hanito, and welcome to Native Chalk Talk, a podcast by Natives for all. Here we're keeping our Native ancestors' stories and history alive, while also sharing with you our Native culture, traditions, and more. I'm Rachel Youngman, a Choctaw originally from Anadarko, Oklahoma. I hope you'll enjoy this journey with me as we learn from our Native American guests. And I hope you'll do me a favor. Feel free to like and share these episodes. I so appreciate it. Yakuki.
Big news, y'all. One of my favorite Choctaw authors, Sarah Elizabeth Sawyer, has a writing course called Fiction Writing American Indians. Now, this course will show you how to discover the insight you need to write quality, authentic stories. You'll also learn practical approaches to researching Native cultures and get answers to hard questions. I'll be taking the same course, and I invite you to take it with me. Just go to AmericanIndians.fictioncourses.com. But don't forget to use the code CHOCTALK, that's CHOCTALK, when you go to checkout to get $30 off. Yes, let's do this.
Dr. Meadows, welcome back to Native Chalk Talk.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah. We were just talking about how we're in an ice storm here in Illinois and in Missouri. So it's crazy out, y'all. By the time this posts, it'll probably be nice and springtimey, but that's what we're looking at, all cozy in our homes today. In the last episode, we talked about Joseph Oklahombi and his contribution to World War I. Now let's learn about another famous code talker, Sergeant Otis Leader. Choctaw author and my friend Sarah Elizabeth Sawyer just published a book called Otis Leader, The Ideal American Doughboy. I can't wait to read it. And I know Sarah admires your research, so you probably got to hear a lot about her book firsthand, right?
Yeah, we were talking back and forth the whole time I was doing mine and the whole time she was doing hers, and, you know, traded information. And then I got to be a proofreader, you know, for hers. So yeah, I've got to enjoy it the whole way along.
That's wonderful. So Sarah, we're excited for you and cheering you on. So I enjoyed reading about Otis in your book. Tell us what you learned about him when you were doing all this research.
Okay. He's born in 1892, close to Scipio, which is at that time Indian Territory, but today would be Pittsburgh County, Oklahoma. He was three quarters Choctaw and Chickasaw, and one fourth Scots-Irish. Went to local schools, had some college. Physically, he was, for that time, particularly a fairly good-sized man. He was 6'3", and there's mentions of him standing out above most people, even later in the army and everything. He married Minnie Leader, and they had three children together. Around 1910, they purchased a new six-room house just a short distance, about 2.5 miles south of Scipio. And he names his property the Excess Ranch. And so he's got some experience in raising livestock and those kind of things. Unfortunately, Minnie dies in January of 1916. And so he is left with three relatively young children and everything when World War I begins.
Yeah, and unfortunately, Minnie dying and leaving him with those three children, it had to have been a time of great sorrow, of course, but also he had to move on, and he is a brave person, a brave man. And so that is definitely shown throughout your book. And when you talk about Otis, tell us about the unusual story of what compelled Otis to enlist and join the U.S. in World War I.
Okay. as the spring of 1917 rolled around, of course, we were assisting Britain and France and Belgium with supplies, but we were not yet in the World War officially yet at this time. And the way that he got involved in it was a little bit happenstance, but also something that was common of the era. So by this time, he was working for some local landowners who had ranching. And there was already at this time, there was a widespread suspicion, lots of speculation and fear about spies. But that was also a reality because there were actual German spies in America, and all countries pretty much spy on one another, particularly when they're in adversarial relationships and everything. So there were news reports and people of being arrested for spying, suspicion of spying, these types of things and everything. Well, in April, early April, he had went down to the Texas stockyards at Fort Worth with the two ranch owners, Mr. Arnold Arne and Carl Marty, who he worked for. They were both naturalized U.S. citizens, but from Switzerland. And they had come to Oklahoma from Chicago to inspect the ranch. They were taking some cattle down to Fort Worth. They were looking at buying some other stock, some new stock to add to the ranch and everything. While they were there, they began to be followed by the newspapers always say it was some federal agents. So it's not really clear exactly what office they were from, but they were watching the area. And what caught their attention was two things. Arne and Marty had distinct Swiss accents and everything. And of course, if you're raised somewhere else, you're going to have that accent pretty much your whole life. And Otis Leder stuck out as not only as a tall man, but he was quite, dark complected and swarthy. And so they began to suspect that Arne and Marty were actually Germans instead of the possibility that they were Swiss. And then they began to assume that Leder, who was with them, obviously, and conversing with them, must be some kind of a spy. So they decided that he must be Spanish of all countries.
Spies, they've come to the stockyards.
They've come to the stockyards. They must be spies. Yes. And so, in hindsight, it is kind of, speculative. But again, at the time, it was a real concern because this did go on in the country at the time. So they follow them around for a while. And there is in one news, one news account where Leder mentions that he thought these guys were just watching them a little too much and everything, kind of noticed them. But they did their business. They got back on the train to go back to McAlester, Oklahoma. And by this time, there had already been a message forwarded ahead by these agents to the local marshal there, a gentleman named Crockett Lee. He had orders basically he had descriptions of them, knew when they were coming in, et cetera, to meet that train at McAlester and to take these three into custody and everything. Well, when they stepped off the train, of course, he knew, and there was also another gentleman with them, Nick Koenig, who was a cattleman in the area. When they stepped off the train, of course, he'd known Leder most of his whole life. He knew some of the other men as well. And so he laughed because he realized that they had made this mistake down in Fort Worth and forwarded this order ahead and everything. So the marshal gets this cleared up and everything with the other officials, but it really peeves Leder. And there had already been articles in the newspaper about agents following spies and things of this nature. Well, this story also circulated both around the Fort Worth area and then up in the McAlester area in Oklahoma. And the news story got picked up. I found accounts of it, as a news release, it gets pumped out to other stations and things. And it was a miscommunication and an assumption of identifying those and everything. But again, it did fit in with the era because it was a reality of the time. But this greatly, angered Leder, not to the point that he, lost his cool or anything, but it really angered him and peeved him. And this is what will result in a little bit in him enlisting.
Wow. Yeah, and Texas and Oklahoma newspapers, like you said, they ran articles about suspected spies being trailed through the stockyards by law enforcement. So, and the timing was interesting because the next day on April 6, 1917, the U.S. declared war against the Central Powers. And what came next was awful, but somewhat amusing. What a mess. An article ran that same day in the McAllister News Capital paper. Here goes. Action of German suspects watched supposed to be coming here to inform Berlin of military work. Three Germans who have been looking at property in Pittsburgh County on the ostensible purpose of investing are being shadowed by government inspectors on the suspicion that they are spies. The three men came here in an automobile from some unknown place last Monday night. They are known to have attended the patriotic rally held here that evening. The next day, they disappeared but returned yesterday. They registered under different names this time, stopping at a different hotel. They were being shown some property near McAllister today by an Indian. The theory on which the investigation is being conducted is that these men are reporting the military activity here to Berlin by the wireless station said to be located near Mexico City. The Germans are being shadowed constantly. Arrest will follow immediately upon the commission by them of any act on which charges should be placed. So this really shows the views and fears of that period of time, and also what misinformation they just immediately judged these are Germans. But there's even deeper reasoning, I thought, which was interesting, involved here. Tell us about the Mexico tie to all of this.
Yeah, a lot of Americans have forgotten that Mexico had considered allying with Germany against the U.S. during World War I. And there's a famous document, I believe it's called the Zimmermann Telegraph or Memo, that is very well recorded in history. And, of course, it's on the web and everything. But there was, and I think Germany reached out to Mexico in this regard. I'd have to check that. But, yes, there was a contemplation of possibly joining Germany in World War I against the United States. And that, of course, would have created a totally different scenario and a two-front kind of campaign and everything. And so, wow. Like I said, there were individuals, all the countries at this time, including us, had people spying for information and everything. So this did resonate a deep fear. And eventually there would be a rebuttal to this, where the newspaper identifies that it wasn't who they thought they were in this case, but the damage was done as far as the leader was concerned. Wow. The mere thought of treason and being unpatriotic to his home area was just not acceptable to him.
Yeah, it would be very insulting for sure. I'm glad he used it for fodder later when he was in battle. So as you mentioned, Army intelligence wired orders for arrest of the spies. U.S. Marshal Crockett Lee was waiting at the station. And when Lee saw his friend Otis depart from the train, he realized the enormity of the mistake and quickly straightened everything out. It's a good thing he knew him. So the newspapers, as you said, clarified the incident. And I assume in a small town like this, the mistake would just be devastating. At the time, Otis was 34 years old. His wife had died, and he was the father of three small children, as we mentioned earlier. He was given 2 weeks to get his affairs in order. On April 30th, 1917, he bid his three children, mother and sister, goodbye and reported to the Oklahoma City recruiting office on May 1st. Now, Otis kept a diary, which I'm sure was super helpful in your research about his time in the service. In fact, something he wrote about was that incident with the accusation of being a spy. And this really had me teary-eyed the first time I read it. He said, "I went into the service to serve my country under the shadow as a spy. And I knew that right would be corrected. So I went into the war with a clear conscience and knew what I was doing. I had determined to go through with it, even if it cost my life." There are a few things to unwrap here. First off, he was Native American, and it seems like he had done well for himself with his job and farm and family and kids, even though, of course, his wife had unfortunately passed away. And something like this probably took him back to a feeling of unworthiness, and that's just my speculation. What I think is admirable, though, is his reaction wasn't to cower away somewhere. He decided to go fight for his country. Amazing. So where was Otis Leader placed in the service?
Initially, he volunteered for cavalry, and we still had cavalry units at that time. However, his height and size, he was a big man for that time. 6'3" is a very big individual back in this time. And he was very, lean and trim and everything. And so because of his size, he was placed in the regular army because he was considered, his mass and everything was considered really kind of too much for cavalry and everything. And wow. So eventually when he enters, like you said, he has a couple weeks to get his affairs in order. He gets relatives to look after, his children and everything. And then ultimately he's sent to New Mexico. He goes through basic and goes to New Mexico. And there were still actions going on patrolling the U.S.-Mexican border in regards to Pancho Villa. So remember, there was a raid on Columbus, New Mexico, a little bit earlier than this. And so there was a tremendous amount of troops mobilized and sent down to the U.S.-Mexican border to guard it. And then some contingents went on into Mexico with General Pershing to pursue Pancho Villa. And then after this, he was assigned to the Company H of the 16th Infantry in the 1st Infantry Division. So what we know today is the Big Red One.
Okay, yeah, very interesting about Pancho Villa at that time in history. It's hard to remember that those two things were going on around the same time. So Leader was eventually sent to Fort Worth, then to France. And in Fort Worth, he marched through the streets with his fellow infantrymen. He wrote in his diary, "We had to take our annual 36-hour exercise by marching through the streets, which brought back to me the memory of what had happened just a short time before about my being accused as a spy. In 30 days from enlistment, I was on my way to France and wished for this immigration agent to come around and see me while I was there. Look at me now," type of thing. So on June 14th, the 1st Division sailed on the SS Saratoga from Hoboken, and they were greeted by a not so pleasant welcome, correct?
Yes. On the way there on June 22nd, they came in contact with a German submarine that attacked his transport. And so there was a couple shots fired. One went to the bow and another behind the stern. Their ship took some defensive measures to turn to avoid them and everything. And they were not damaged or severely. So they skipped the danger or stepped over it, you might say, on the way there.
Yeah.
And this was a common problem at the time. German submariners were looking for supply ships, but also troop ships, anything of that nature. And there were destroyers nearby who did release some depth charges, to take counter against the submarines. So that was quite a shakeup on the way there. I do not know that anyone was harmed on his ship or anything of that nature, but still a serious close call.
For sure. Not exactly a warm welcome.
No.
But there was a warm welcome to come. Upon arrival in France in June, Leader marched in yet another parade in Paris on July 4th. Something interesting came about during that parade. Tell us about that.
Yeah, the first division from the U.S. was one of the very first sets of troops that we sent over for World War I. And so, yes, they had been asked to participate in a parade and everything. And while they were marching, unbeknownst to Leader, there's a pretty well-known French artist, Raymond Devereaux. He did a number of paintings for the French army and the government and things of this nature. But he had been commissioned by the French government to paint portraits of the Allied army and also to be on the lookout or to seek a model to paint what he might consider as the model original American soldier, perhaps like an archetype or a good representative of the American army and soldiers and everything. So watching the parade, he saw an individual that caught his eye. His his stature, his demeanor, you know, his posture, but also his, you know, his skin tone, his height. He saw this darker complected individual marching with his unit, and it really struck him. And so he began to make an effort. He knew what unit it was in front of him. So he began to make efforts to locate this individual.
Wow. What an honor. So on June 6th, Otis and the First began training, and Devereaux showed up and was taken to an American colonel who was clearly angered by the painter's presence. And in broken English, Devereaux informed the commander officer that he wanted to paint a picture of the ideal American soldat, and that the painting would be hung in the Salle des Invalides. How did the colonel respond?
So yeah, when he shows up, he's there's two or three different accounts of it, but they're really just kind of annoyed and don't want to be bothered with him. His English isn't perfect and everything. It's not pertinent to their cause, their training, what they're doing. And so they're really trying to just brush him off, you know, and not be super, super, you know, mean, but just to brush him off and get rid of him. And then he produces a document then. And basically it's a request from the French government. But more importantly, it bore the insignia of the American General Headquarters and was personally signed by General John J. Pershing, making it an order. And so when they saw the paper that he carried with that signature, everything completely changed. The sun came out and doors opened and, you know, everything changed. And so he described who he was after, who he was looking for. And he described Leader as a half-blood Choctaw native from Oklahoma, straight as an arrow, standing over 6 feet tall. His perception, you know, being keen, alert, yet bearing a calmness that betokens strength, and naturally a bronze face reflecting the spirit that they took across with them, the spirit that eventually turned the tide. And this, of course, is a little flowery from Devereaux's standpoint, but they quickly figured out that he wants Leader. That's Otis Leader. And so they got him, and then arrangements were made for him to paint him.
Wow, so cool. And in his diary, Leader described his experience of being painted. "I had the honor to be the one who was selected for the painting from among the many. I posed for 3 days, and he said the picture would be finished in Paris. The painting hangs today in the French Federal Building in Paris." So listeners, if you're in Paris, go see the painting of Otis Leader. The soldiers trained under the French 47th Division, Les Diables Bleus, through October 21st, 1917. After training, the 1st Division entered combat. Tell us more.
So his company is noted because they are essentially perhaps the first American unit to go into combat. Mm-hmm. And again, they spent the bulk of the summer just training and getting familiarized and everything. And then later in 17, when they went into service. And so they took some of the first German fire. Leader stated, he described how the Germans had raided, very close to his area, raided their lines and everything, from his battalion. And so, three men had been killed, five had been injured, and approximately 11 taken prisoner, by the Germans. And these were actually the first American casualties of our troops in World War I, and Leader was in that same battalion where that happened and everything. So the trenches had been raided by the Germans. They were retaken by Americans the following day. And what we're going to see then is that Otis Leader gets involved in some of frequent and quite intense fighting very, very early in the start of the war for the Americans.
So starting in April of 1918, the Americans captured over 12,000 enemy soldiers on the first day of the offensive, captured towns, and beat back more than seven counterattacks. In charge of a machine gun squad, Leader, among many others, was wounded on the 28th. Sounds like he was making big strides being in charge of the machine gun squad. Leader recovered, but later his crew faced more hardships. One of the artillery blasts killed all of Leader's machine gun crew except him. What did he say about this in his diary?
He described, the hottest part of the battle was raging, and I was advancing with fellow members of my company to the enemy's line in the face of that fire. We had progressed without mishap when suddenly a German incendiary bomb landed in the center of our column, wiping out every member of the crew but myself and destroying our gun. The explosion left me alone in no man's land and suffering from a severe shock from the shell. I have had several experiences in which I figured my last call had come, but this one was worth considering when I saw my whole crew blown, as it were, almost from under my feet. So that would have been quite a shock, literally his whole crew taken out in a single explosion.
For sure. Yeah. So I had no idea how brave and impactful Otis Leader was in the war. What else did he say about being in the war?
He writes, "We were out on the gun and had been getting fire from German guns, making it hot for us. A couple of boys came up as our relief. So this Polish boy and I decided to get them." So he's decided to move against the German position that's firing on them. Leader and his assistant gunner grabbed up a couple of weapons. He describes they were rifles of an automatic sort. They took them from dead French soldiers. And then we took off through the field around them, continuing gesturing to the left to get behind them. My Polish boy got hit and fell into a shell hole, but I kept on and got in behind them. I poked the gun over a mound of dirt thrown over the trench and yelled at them. I don't know what I said, just sort of hooped. And this is something I've come across in other accounts, that many of the native soldiers in World War I would give war cries or hoops upon attacking the Germans. And from the German viewpoint, that was very, very unsettling. And it kind of scared them or intimidated them. It was just something different than what non-Indian soldiers did and everything.
Yes.
The Germans turned around, and he writes, "I waved at them with one hand while keeping the gun pointed at them to get them to put up their hands. And they all went up like this, raising their hands. After motioning the 18 Germans at the two machine gun nests out of the trench, Leader marched them back across no man's land, despite heavy artillery shelling, to return them into a group of astonished Marines of the 5th and 6th Regiments. He concluded, "Not a one of us got hurt." What made the action really more incredible was the fact that Leader accomplished it with an empty weapon. As he wrote, "I had only one shell," he laughed, "and I didn't know how to load it." So he picked up a firearm style that he was not familiar with and actually didn't have sufficient ammunition for. When his wife interrupted him during the interview to ask him what he would have done if he had needed to shoot, he grinned and shrugged his shoulders. So in this instance, just simply his bravado and actions was enough to persuade the Germans to surrender and everything, but a very daring act. And because of this, he was awarded the French Croix de Guerre with a palm for this action, as well as a Silver Star, which was then referred to as the Silver Citation Star. So a very, very important act, and one of tremendous bravery, one man capturing 18.
Yes, definitely. Wow. By the way, listeners, Leader was wounded again on July 18th when an exploding shell gassed and hospitalized him for the second time during this campaign. It's amazing what he went through and survived, not to mention the emotional and mental side of things. Tell us about that part of it.
As Leader recalled, "We were always told several hours in advance of an impending charge, and the intervening time was spent in serious thought on the part of the Americans, for we did not know whether we would live to see the finish of what the day began." When the signal to advance was given, however, all was changed. Every man forgot his fears and thought only of fighting. After 6 months of being in combat, Brigadier General Frank Parker awarded a citation to the 1st Division for never surrendering an inch of ground to the enemy and for taking 100 prisoners for every one that they lost.
We'll be back after this quick break. Are you looking for the perfect gift for your significant other, your bestie, or even yourself? You know you're worth it. Luxury soaps, lotions, and lip balms from Baker's Bar Soapery are 100% Choctaw crafted, and they make the perfect gifts. This work of art is their signature turquoise soap, and it's made to look like Sleeping Beauty turquoise. Do you see this gold veining throughout? And the gold marbling on top? Love it. Next, check out this Apple Mint custom fragrance oil soap called Say Their Name. And all proceeds go to the Missing Murdered Indigenous Women Choctaw cause. You'll only find this blend made specifically for this soap. And yes, these are made with goat's milk, which leaves your skin feeling soft and supple. So load up on these Choctaw soaps made by Tiffany at Baker's Bar Soapery at thebbsoapery.com. But be sure to get 20% off when you use the code NATIVECHOCKTALK, that's all caps, when you spend $25 or more. Treat yourself to the luxury your skin deserves with Baker's Bar Soapery.
Eventually, Leader participated in the Meuse Argonne campaign that began in September of 1918. And is this the point at which he was also a code talker?
I think it was near around that time, probably towards the very end of the war. It's not really known exactly when or with whom Leader spoke Choctaw during the war. The best account that we have is an interview that he actually gave, and I think it came out in a 1958 newspaper clipping. But he talks about the last time he was wounded. He was recovering in a hospital, and they decided they would not let him return back to action. And so he describes that he was summoned and called out of the hospital to go and speak Choctaw on the phone for the services. So it would be somewhere after his second wound while he was recovering.
Interesting. I know at one point Leader stated the Germans put Russians, Italians to listen in, but they just couldn't understand Choctaw. So on October 1st, 1918, Leader was wounded again. What happened?
This time he was wounded by shrapnel and gas attack, and was hospitalized. It occurred during an artillery shelling that involved very thick gas attack. And it took a lot of casualties on Leader's position and everything. And out of his immediate unit, only Leader and two others actually survived and everything. And for this, he received a second Silver Star, at that time Silver Citation Star, for this action. And looking at the context of the stories and the accounts that he gave, it would be sometime after this that he appears to have been, after recovering a while, then used to speak Choctaw.
So then the armistice was signed on November 11th, 1918, ending the war. And he arrived back in the U.S. in New Jersey on December 16th of that same year. What a hero. So what else do you know of Otis Leader's accolades and accomplishments?
One, there was a citation that he received from Cato Sells, who was the Commissioner of Indian Affairs and Secretary of the Interior. It's doubtful if a more brilliant one stands to the credit of any soldier than the achievement of Otis W. Leader, a part Choctaw and Chickasaw Indian who received the Croix de Guerre under an attack, under an order of Marshal Petain, the French commander. He rose to the rank of corporal. We know that. In total, he was wounded twice and gassed twice. And for that, on his uniform, he wore two wound stripes and two gas stripes. There is some mention in some of the articles where The context is not totally clear. He may have been wounded a third time and simply not reported it, or, you know, just shook it off and went on. But it's a little bit unclear on that. He was awarded 2 French Croix de Guerre medals, 2 silver citation stars, the Purple Heart with clusters for multiple times of being wounded, and the World War I Victory Medal with 5 stars, which would indicate 5 campaigns. And so on some of the photos, you'll see where they have what they call campaign bars. They are slender rectangular bars that hang down beneath the medal, and they contain the names of the campaigns they were in, like Meuse-Argonne, and so forth and so on, those kind of things. To sum it up, General Pershing described Leader as one of the war's greatest fighting machines.
Wow. Do you ever think that, was it always seen as, well, as a Choctaw and as an Indian, he did really well? Or was it, did he just stand out on his own as, you know, I would think so, with General Pershing saying that, greatest fighting machine. What do you think? Do you think he was categorized in a separate from everyone else?
It's kind of hard to say at this point. He could have been, because to my knowledge, there was not a lot of Indians in the first. There were some sprinkled around, but not like later with the 36th, you know, which had whole companies almost of Native people. So some of that might have been some of that Indian scout syndrome we talked about earlier of stereotyping. Mm-hmm. But also, I think, you know, to his credit, just the sheer things that he did, regardless of background, are just
right. Surely. Yeah.
And so he earned, you know, he probably earned way more than what he received, but he received several prestigious awards.
Fantastic. Well deserved as well. So what did Leader do after the war?
He had an interesting, you know, post-war career. He actually engaged in several types of employment and everything. So he was discharged on June 6, 1919. At first, he did some special investigative work for the MK&T and Rock Island Railroads. He also did some guard duty for the state penitentiary at McAllister, which was very close to home there. The next year, the following year, or later that year, he took some vocational training and went to work, but he was still undergoing treatment for exposure to mustard gas. And so he would have some trouble with the mustard gas he received, and then also in shortly coming up, tuberculosis as well. And so within 3 years, by 1922, he contracted tuberculosis as a result of his lungs already being weakened because of the mustard gas that he had received on more than one occasion and everything. Ugh. And so this put a temporary interruption into his plans and his abilities. But before he could be treated for the tuberculosis, he suffered an acute appendicitis. And so that had to be dealt with surgically and everything. As soon as he recovered from that, he was sent to Whipple Barracks in Prescott, Arizona, where his tuberculosis was arrested. And so that was a common, I even had a relative of my own, a grandmother's brother, that had to do that, had to move to Arizona and stay there because of lung problems and tuberculosis. The dry, arid air helped with that. So a lot of people went west for that. That was finally checked and taken care of. In 1924, he joined the Oklahoma State Highway Department, which would have been a good job and steady employment and everything of that nature working for the state. And he eventually got transferred down to Hollis, which is in the very southwest tip of Oklahoma, and spent quite a few years working down there and everything.
So obviously this man had to have been the toughest person on the planet.
He was. That's a couple of things I always draw from his accounts, you know, not trying just to speculate, but he seems to have been a man of many talents. He also seems, the descriptions of him from multiple people was that he was not only strong, but he was also kind of calm and measured and thoughtful and everything. I don't see any accounts that describe him as, you know, panicking or overreacting or whatever. He seems to be steady and measured. And and this may have been one of the reasons he was put in charge of the machine gun squad. He was quite a few years older. If you remember, he was, I think, close to 34 when he went in service. So he would have been much older than the men, other men in his unit. And that age and maturity probably helped him rise and have some leadership capabilities, you know.
Your book says in 1935, he was transferred from Hollis to Lehigh in Cole County, Oklahoma, where he bought a home atop a large hill with a commanding view of the area. I looked up Lehigh and it supposedly is a ghost town now. Did you know that?
Yeah, just a wide spot in the road, I believe.
Yeah. For many years, Leader belonged to American Legion Post 35 in Oklahoma City, serving as Sergeant at Arms in the late 1950s. Tell us about the last years of Leader's life.
Again, I think this reflects back to not only his personal demeanor, but veterans in general. He didn't speak much about his wartime experiences, you know. And there's, you know, even in his diary, there's a lot of things he could have written about or detailed that we know he experienced it, but he didn't dwell on the overly negative or gruesome parts of it and everything. So he kept a lot of his individual actions and things pretty much to himself and everything. Later in years in life, in the last few years of his life, there were people that reached out to him for several newspaper interviews, and he did relay some of it. But he also relayed some of the funnier, lighter moments as well, which was typical of veterans of all periods, you know. His wounds did continue to persist and nag at him the rest of his life. And so particularly his lungs were a little bit weaker because of the gas. But cold weather particularly brought back discomfort. And there's a lot of, again, another common, anybody who's had things broken or those type of long outside activities. In May of 48, he was hospitalized at Will Rogers Veterans Hospital for a bone infection related to his war injuries. We don't know if he got some shrapnel in him that remained, but it's very likely. That's a common problem, and a lot of times not all the shrapnel is removed, so many soldiers still have it in them and everything. The infection force leader, he was then an auditor with the engineering department of the Oklahoma Highway Commission. It caused him to have to basically retire. And he had worked there for over 24 years. So that was his primary career with the Oklahoma State Highway Department and everything. In 1955, he suffered a stroke and a cerebral hemorrhage and entered into the Muskogee Veterans Hospital for treatment for that. A lot of recognition began to pick up, particularly in the, say, 1955 to 1960 period here and everything. The State House of Representatives passed a resolution that designated him as the outstanding soldier of World War I in Oklahoma, and that was signed by Governor Raymond Gary. And he was still mobile. He's described in the June 1955 article as still displaying that, and I quote, old fighting spirit. And he retained, I remember from reading the accounts, he still had a sense of humor and that kind of thing. But his health was continuing to slowly decline and everything.
I hate to hear it because he obviously was such a great hero. And the fact that he suffered quite a bit at the end, you know, had to have been really, really hard to go through. Tell us about the newspaper article and his invitation to France.
So around on April 20th, 1958, so this is roughly 40 years to the day when Leader first saw action in France, a French newspaper ran an article on him with his picture. And this was, of course, someone saw this and cut it out and sent it to him and everything. The French had viewed Leader as the most perfect example of the American soldiers who had sacrificed and bravely served to save their country from tyranny. General Patrick J. Hurley contacted Leader and offered him a trip to France. Leader initially agreed, thought about it and agreed, wanted to go back over and see things. But he began to, he had to decline because he was still having some poor health issues and everything. So in turn, Hurley arranged, if he couldn't make the trip, he wanted to do something to help Leader and, you know, to kind of, you know, as a thank you. But he arranged for funds to buy a new car for Leader and for the remainder to be placed in a bank account for him. However, the plan was noble, but this would have interfered with his pension and his veterans funds. So because the gifts would have compromised this, Hurley presented the car to the Colgate Veterans of Foreign War Club, and it was understood this was for Otis Leader to use whenever he needed.
Aww.
And so in that way, it could be done, you know, legally and everything, but a great gesture and everything.
That's amazing. General Hurley obviously had big respect for Otis Leader.
I think Hurley served in the unit in the same division with Leader in World War One.
There was
a connection. There was an old connection between the two.
Huh. Very interesting. And by the way, y'all, Colgate is just near Lehigh. And I've driven through Colgate many times, and I never knew of the connection there to Otis Leader. So there's much more to learn about Otis and Oklahoma and Dr. Meadows' book. So again, listeners, I highly recommend getting this book to delve in deeper. Get it for yourself, get it for family members, anyone that also is interested in learning about World War One as well. Delve in deeper into the worlds of these heroes. They deserve our respect. And what's interesting to me is that even after all Leader went through, he stated that his greatest sorrow was when he was suspected of being a German spy in the spring of 1917, which really shows how hard this hit his pride and his sense of patriotism for his country. But as you state in the book, however, his vase of joy was filled when he was selected as the model original American soldier to have his portrait painted and hung on the walls of the French Federal Building, where the pictures of all allied races meet. That gives me goosebumps. So what ultimately happened to our hero, Otis Leader?
In November of 1960, he suffered another stroke and led him to have to get hospital treatment and everything. He pretty much spent the last few months there and everything. On March 26th of 1961, he passed at the Ardmore Veterans Hospital. He was then 79 years old. And a funeral service was held for him at the American Legion Building in Colgate, which, you know, properly so, his home area. And then he was buried in the Colgate, Oklahoma Cemetery, where he is today and everything.
I need to go by there and see his grave. As you state in your book, the following day, the Oklahoma State Senate issued a resolution expressing regret for his passing. I find it interesting the contrast between the stories of Oklahoma and Otis after the war. Although the Choctaw lost two of their greatest war veterans, Oklahoma and Leader, within the space of less than a year, the story of the Choctaw Code Talkers of World War One was far from over. The Choctaw first formally recognized their Code Talkers in 1986. In 1989, the French government and the state of Oklahoma jointly recognized the Choctaw Code Talkers of both world wars. Obviously, the Code Talkers are fascinating to everyone, but I still have some questions around how the Choctaws transmitted messages on the front line. So what was that process of the Choctaws transmitting important messages on the front line?
And to bounce back a little bit to an earlier session, so when they were assigned with the duty of taking Forest Firm, which the French had tried to take twice and had been repulsed, this is when the idea and the request for eight Choctaws came down to Captain Horner. and Elijah Horner, and where he solicited 8 guys out of his troops there, out of Company E, and used them. They used it in that one campaign between, that one battle between October 26th and 28th, were relieved shortly after that on the 29th, spent a few days marching back to a relief camp, and then 18 Choctaws were recruited and 3 non-commissioned officers for a week of training. And this is where the idea came down then that we would begin to create actual vocabulary, special words for newer types of technology. So the original message that they were given, the one that has survived, they were given it in written English and then, of course, translated into Choctaw Senate. And then, of course, it was retranslated and everything. But with the training, which unfortunately they didn't get to use because the armistice came the day after they finished, but that's where the idea of creating actual code terms and plugging them into a native language comes from. And, of course, that, to me, that's so important because that sets the template or the method that will be expanded upon in World War II. As far as we know, and we only have one message, the original message, or one of the main messages was recorded in English and has survived in the archives, and it's in the book. And this was from Colonel Bloor and everything. But the messages were written in English, given to them. They would send it into Choctaw, and then it would be translated back into English and passed around within the local unit and everything. When they initially started their training to develop code words, they would then substitute, for example, let's say you wanted to talk about a particular company. Well, then we might say, okay, 1 grain of corn for, you know, this company, 2 grains of corn for a second company, so forth and so on. Big gun was used for artillery, little gun shoot fast for a machine gun, etc. So they're basically descriptions that are, on one hand, they're new terms, they're new combinations, because Choctaws have not had that kind of technology or needed to use this kind of vocabulary before.
Right.
but they're very accurate and they're very specific at the same time. So they're well formed, very well formed. And so, like, the word for the word they used for gas was just bad air, which is exactly what gas is, you know. Right. So they were creating terms like this. And I think there was around somewhere between 15 and 20 terms that were created during that training session. And then those would have been implemented had they went back into service and everything. The value of it was this was much faster than coding and decoding any type of system that we had at that time. It was as quick as I talking to you and you turn back around and put it into English, you know.
Faster and obviously more secure because it couldn't be decoded. So some of those military term Choctaw pronunciation translations that you just mentioned went as follows. I'll just name a few. So 1st Battalion was Tanchi Nihi Achuffa, or 1 grain of corn in Choctaw. Machine gun was Tanam Pushi, which was little gun shoot fast in Choctaw. Grenade was Tali, or stone in Choctaw. Patrol was Tikba Pisalawa, which means many scouts in Choctaw. Army or soldier was Tushka Chipota, or in Choctaw, soldier, army, military. And obviously these codes completely stumped the Germans. But not only that, your book says some evidence suggests that many Germans were fascinated, yet somewhat fearful of Native Americans. German interest in American Indians had existed for decades through museum displays, popular literature, and visiting contingents of natives in Wild West shows performing in dances, mock battles, and hunting, and in mock villages. So that's interesting. What else can you tell us about that?
There's several things that were going on. One is there, you know, there's a lot of Germans that had immigrated to the United States in the 1800s. And there's a big cluster of German immigrants that ended up in Texas, you know, in the 1840s and 50s. And so they had encounters with natives. They sometimes had to fight them as well. And so they had their accounts that they recorded, as well as letters and things that they sent back to Germany, which again is limited information, but would project certain imagery in their popular thought. Another issue as the 1800s rolled on a little bit is the author Carl May, Carl with a K. So Carl May is, I would describe him as he's the German Louis L'Amour. He is probably the greatest Western writer of novels and entertaining stories and things from a German perspective. And so he wrote a lot of Western novels in German, in Germany, but had oftentimes focused upon or had elements involving Native Americans and elements of their culture, less or more accurate at times and everything. But this was hugely popular. This is back in the day of like dime novels in the United States. It was massive pulp fiction reading that people took. And of course, they didn't really have much of a way to check this.
Right.
You know, it wasn't peer reviewed, obviously, you know, about how much was a little artistic license and accurate and things. But it just like in our own culture, dime novels put certain images of, you know, ferocity of Native Americans and attacks and scalping. And it favored certain types of imagery that became what the populace knew and yes. accepted. Fact about Native Americans. So that was a huge aspect too. And then of course, you know, there was a lot of emphasis on their fighting abilities, on the concept of scalping and everything. But then the Wild West shows too, that traveled Germany and England and France extensively in the 1880s and 90s in this period. Of course, most of what they're doing are reenactments or pantomimes of really exciting things. Lots of dancing dressed up in very elaborate regalia. Lots of riding tricks, lots of mock scenes of attacking stagecoaches or attacking a bunch of settlers in wagons. And of course, this is very fast. You know, you got people riding and doing tricks and things on horses. Brandishing weapons, you know, there's even some of these that reenacted scalping and things of that nature too, which of course on a popular level the crowd went wild, as we say, you know. But right. Again, these are the kinds of images that were coming out of Wild West shows, and there wasn't very many of them of just a family around a campfire cooking dinner or telling stories or anything. It was more the things to do with warfare and action. And again, we're getting right. a select number of imagery, you know, like
right.
that.
So, the glamorous
so there's,
part.
There's really several, yeah, several kinds of things here that would have biased the German populace into being kind of, you know, fearful of Native Americans, because for most of them, that's all that they knew was these popular mass entertainment genres.
Yeah. Yeah, and not only were they fascinated by Native American capabilities in battle, it seems like they also just respected those abilities that they had.
Yeah, and there's actually some literature on this. There's a look at them as kind of like a natural warrior, you know, that kind of the ultimate, you know, kind of fighting man, et cetera, and everything. Someone that harkens back, again, stereotypically harkens back to an earlier time with natural skills and everything. There is mention of a commander in the German 97th Landwehr actually giving orders to target Native American snipers when they can be identified and everything. In
wow.
some cases, if you're close enough, that's possible. In others, that might be really hard to tell who is who, you know.
Right.
At a distance and everything. There are also accounts, one in the Stars and Stripes article talking about an American officer that captured by Germans, and he's being interrogated on his division's movements and objectives. Not so much on that, but they're more interested in, does he have natives in his unit? And if so, how many? Which, you know, that, to on most military strategy would have been very far down the line of concerns or things to interview about or interrogate about. But because of their mindset, and there is this real, you know, trepidation about facing natives, they're concerned about it and everything of that nature.
Right.
And, you know, there's another entry that it actually attributes, and again, we, you know, it's hard to go back and validate some of these, but it attributes a retreat by Germans to the realization that they were facing Native Americans. And that's quite possible in certain units where there were high numbers of them. It's described as a general surprise for the Prussian guards when they found themselves facing the species of American fighter. Intelligence summaries failed to tell anything about them, but they were certain guards. There were certain guards who remembered that American Redskins in past wars had been chiefly distinguished by scalping the enemy and wearing paint on their faces. Hmm. So it happened that when the end of the fight was nearing, Prussian guards could be seen running over the hilltops, casting away their rifles, knapsacks, canteens, sacrificing everything for speed. During this action, a German sniper was firing at the American line when a Sioux jumped out of his shell hole and began running towards him. After firing at the Sioux and missing, the German began to run. The Sioux was close behind, yelling and whooping with his bayonet fixed. When the German began to head toward his own lines, his comrades began to fire at him and the Sioux to divert them from their lines. Forced to change his route down the lines, the chase continued for nearly 5 minutes, with the German continuing to fire at both whenever they came close to their lines before ending in an old dugout. And so again, we, you know, this seems to be an instance where they picked up that there were clearly natives that they were facing, and there was some fear caused by that, you know.
I happen to love it, whether it's accurate or not. It's that's fascinating. Your book also states other reports came from the 142nd Infantry. According to Captain E.W. Horner of Company E, his Indians gave the Germans the time of their lives. They not only scared them to death, but gave them the shivers when they turned up at night in the light of a gray moon on scout duty. The Boche couldn't make out the red men at all. Scouting, of course, was second nature to them, and they were in and out of the enemy trenches and dugouts before the Prussians recovered from their scare. So these stories are great, and yet the Germans also felt a little ashamed of their loss to the Native Americans, right?
Yeah, there's some hints that Germans were trying to conceal the fact that Native Americans were fighting against them, and also these inquiries about natives suggest that they are an unusual concern, you know, again, beyond what would normally be standard useful military information. There's a overlying reason which suggests they're the stereotypes they've been led to face and everything.
Our soldiers eventually made their way back home, and your book mentions an article in Tulsa World in 1937. All of the group who played such a wonderful part by using their native tongue at an opportune time lived to return to their own country, the old Choctaw Nation. Here they are living quiet lives on farms or in timbered sections of the state. And what else would you add to that?
There's a, you know, when you, what data we have on some of the men, they went back to a wide variety of jobs, but like most veterans, happy to have survived the war above all else and just wanted to get back to their normal life. So there are several men that worked in lumber companies and sawmills. And of course, Choctaw Country has, you know, tremendous amount of timbered land and forestry down in that area. After the return home in 1919, there was increasingly newspaper articles and things that specifically related how they had used their language in the war and everything. Most of these initially do not include any accounts from the Choctaws themselves. It's all from their officers. It's from other people in the military. And even, like we say, one of the speeches up to the division commander, a two-star general. So that undoubtedly, you know, I'm speculating here, but I'm sure when they heard of these or came across them, it had to make them feel proud. Even just for the other Choctaws to see it, that some of the other Choctaws were code talkers, and to have a unique contribution is the way I would look at it, you know. So that had to make them feel good and everything. Solomon Lewis reported in one article that there were medals promised to the Choctaw code talkers, but there was really none ever given. We don't have the specifics on what type of medal or who promised it or anything of that nature. So that's kind of hard to know exactly what was aimed at there.
Yeah.
Thing. And then, as I said, General William Smith, you know, mentioned the contributions of only one group. He praised the 36th Division. And of course there were many kinds of Americans in that unit, many different immigrant populations and things of this nature. But the only one that he singled out for special recognition were Native Americans. And I think that speaks wonderfully for their contributions, you know.
Absolutely, it does. Well-deserved, gents. Were any of our Choctaws actually captured? I don't remember seeing that anywhere in the book, if they were.
Not that I know of. There's several Native Americans in the 142nd and the 36th Division in general that were killed and wounded and everything. But in the 142nd, none that I know of Natives that were captured.
Wow. That's amazing, actually. So not one was captured, and I couldn't be prouder to be Choctaw. Listeners, stay tuned for the next and final episode where we'll talk about the Oklahoma Cherokee, Comanche, and other tribes who also served our country as code talkers in World War I. Dr. Meadows Yakuki, again, for taking time to share this important information.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
You are most welcome. Thanks for listening to Native Chalk Talk. Be sure to join our community on YouTube, Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. And check us out at nativechalktalk.com. Stay tuned for the next episode. You're going to love it. Yakuki, thank you, my friends.